from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1606, England was reeling from a plague, a terrorist plot to blow up Parliament and the King. There were deep religious rifts, political rifts, division, polarization. It was also the year William Shakespeare wrote the tragedies Macbeth, Antony and Cleopatra, and King Lear, a prodigious creative achievement. This hour on Point, Shakespeare scholar James Shapiro on how a troubled year for England brought three great Shakespeare tragedies and how the Bard's insights then on human nature and the world may speak to us now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you felt it lately? Sound and fury signifying nothing, a plague upon you, murderers, traitors all. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Just a taste of the Bard in 1606 here from Roman Polanski's Macbeth from, you'll hear it, Awake.
Awake! Ring the alarm bell! Murder and treason!
Not happy times. And here from King Lear, Nesbitt Blaisdell, betrayed by two of his three daughters, his mind starting to go. Here he addresses a storm raging around him, 1606.
Blow winds and crack your cheeks. Rage, blow. You cataracts and hurricanoes spout till you have drenched our steeples, drowned the cocks. You sulfurous and thought-executing fires, vaunt couriers of oak-cleaving thunderbolts, singe my white head.
There, from King Lear. Joining me now from New York is James Shapiro, professor of English at Columbia University. His new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. James Shapiro, Jim, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure speaking with you today, Tom.
Set us in the time, set the man in the time. He was, what, 42 years old, Shakespeare, the Bard, in 1606?
Shakespeare's 42, probably the most experienced playwright of the Elizabethan and Jacobean era at this point, has written tragedies, histories, comedies, and had fallen into something of a fallow period since he had written Hamlet at the turn of the century. And this year, as you've already described, is an enormously prolific one for him, in which he finally found his footing and was able to respond to the times. These were very bad days for England that turned into very good days for Shakespeare creatively.
Writing tragedies, masterpieces. He was very attuned to his times always, you remind us, James Shapiro. He wasn't locked away being inspired by something beyond the affairs of men. What went on around William Shakespeare came out in his work.
There was no radio in 1606. There was yet no newspapers. Theater was the place where Shakespeare and his contemporaries gathered to make sense of their world in a way that we don't rely on one media today. And it was extraordinary. It was a drama that talked about the political crises, the economic pressures, the social changes and tectonic shifts going on in this culture. The playwrights who captured that best were the most successful, and Shakespeare remains the most successful then, and because of that, in a way, and we could talk about that, remains so today, 400 years later.
So put us in the news of the time. What was going on with plague, with terror plots, with borders and immigration and cultures and religion and division? Put us in Shakespeare's 1606.
Absolutely. Let me begin with plague. Plague had struck Shakespeare's native Stratford-upon-Avon when he was born. And in a way, we almost lost Shakespeare then. Neighbors, young children on his street died that year. For some reason, he survived that outbreak of plague and may have developed immunity to it. When he came to London and became a playwright in the early 1590s, plague struck again. And when I mean struck again, on an order that, say, Ebola, that scare recently, kind of created in Africa, less so in Europe and America, 1/7 of London died in 1592-1593. It struck again in 1603 with the same devastation. And in late 1605 and again in 1606, plague returned, arriving really into Shakespeare's own parish in London and right up to his doorstep. To give you a sense of what it felt, let me read just a few lines from another playwright, Thomas Dekker, who describes what it's like to be in a plague house. If you were in a house where somebody had plague sores and was infected, neighbors or the authorities would lock up that house for 28 days to make sure plague didn't spread. This is what Dekker writes. What an unimaginable torment were it for a man to be barred up every night in a vast, silent charnel house, where all the pavement should, instead of green rushes, be strewed with blasted rosemary, the bare ribs of a father that begat him lying there, here, the chapless, hollow skull of a mother that bore him, round him a thousand corpses, some standing bolt upright in their knotted winding sheet, others half molded in rotten coffins. It was terrifying, and everybody dreaded that, and everybody feared their neighbors, friends, and relatives contracting plague.
And it comes right out in Macbeth. You remind us he's talking about good men's lives. Those good men, they expire before the flowers in their caps dying or ere they sicken.
That's about the best encapsulation of how terrifying it was. You could leave the house in the morning with a flower in your cap, and by afternoon you'd be in your grave. So it certainly focused the minds of Shakespeare's audiences powerfully. And of course, when there were more than 40 plague deaths reported in London, theaters were closed. So Shakespeare really hoped that plague would disappear. And unfortunately for Shakespeare and for his even for his landlady, Mary Mountjoy, who died this year, probably from the plague along with many neighbors, it struck close to home for Shakespeare.
What a sense of the acute threat to life that lay behind everything at this time. Then we go to terror. And you had just at the end of the previous year, 1605, the famous gunpowder plot, Guy Fawkes, and all that. Remind us of that and its impact on the culture.
In early November of 1605, a group of 20 or so disaffected Catholic gentry who felt King James would never really tolerate the Catholics plotted to blow up the king, the royal family, and the political and religious leadership of England, blow the Scots back to Scotland, and restore Catholicism and, in a sense, roll back the Reformation. And they got really close to succeeding. Guy Fawkes was caught matches in hand the night before everyone was to gather in the House of Lords.
Including the king.
Including the king, the queen, and the king's two sons. Mm-hmm. And the plan was to race up to Shakespeare country, where the king's young daughter named Elizabeth was living in a household away from court, kidnap her, make her a Catholic queen of England, and have an uprising. We think of November the 5th, 1605, as the key date. But in fact, the first half of 1606 was devoted to capturing, torturing, publicly trying, and then brutally publicly executing and eviscerating and beheading the gunpowder plotters. And then
while they were still alive.
The Elizabethans really had punishment down to a science.
Okay.
So you were hanged for a while, cut down before you were dead, cut open. In fact, your heart was ripped out while you were still alive.
Okay, so
and
one of the
gunpowder plotters reputedly said when the executioner ripped out his heart, held it up to the crowd and said, "Here is the heart of a traitor." Sir Everard Digby, in his dying breath, reportedly said, "Thou liest."
Liest. Wow. So we've got plague. We've got a terror plot. So terror on people's minds. And then we've got religion, division, borders, fear of immigration, of the other with Scotland and the Protestant Catholic division. King James, who'd ruled Scotland and wanted to put it all together.
King James was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, was a Catholic. Mm-hmm. King James's wife, Anne, was a practicing Catholic. So the Catholics assumed he would tolerate them, even though he himself was Protestant. He was also a Scot, King James VI of Scot. And when he came down to England in 1603 to succeed the old Virgin Queen Elizabeth, who people were getting really tired of, the nation was exuberant, and they were happy to have a king who had two sons. The whole succession crisis that had preoccupied England and Shakespeare as well was over. The problem was King James wanted to unite the kingdoms of Scotland and England, and it turned out that no one else really wanted to. He stood before Parliament and said, "What God hath conjoined, let no man separate. I am the husband, and all the whole isle is my lawful wife. I hope no man will be so unreasonable as to think that I, that I'm a Christian king under the gospel, should be a polygamist and husband to two wives." He saw Scotland as one wife, England as the other wife, and he did everything he could to unite them. But
a lot of the English not into that, like Americans saying, well, we'll just unite with Mexico. Well, maybe not.
Sure. Let's create a North American configuration. What James did was invent an identity crisis where none had been before. And no one was better at exploiting identity crises than William Shakespeare.
James Shapiro. The new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. Behind us right here from the Fox TV hit show Empire, sort of inspired by King Lear. Little theme music there. Empire, music from poor Yorick to cite a Shakespearean character. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Or outside my door, ready for war, right here and now. Oh, and we're marching in. Oh, and we're marching in. Oh, and we're marching in.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about William Shakespeare and the year 1606, a tough year, a year of plague and strife, a distant echo, maybe, of our own time. The year he wrote brought out Macbeth and King Lear, Antony and Cleopatra. Jim Shapiro writes it all up in his new book, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us this hour. Does the history here bring you closer to Shakespeare, maybe help you see our time of troubles through his eyes, with his wisdom, his insight? Do you find yourself these days sometimes with a more tragic view of life, things that cannot be fixed around us, or seem so anyway, maybe as they might have felt in 1606? Here's a little bit from just one of those three great masterpieces of that year, Macbeth year, played by Patrick Stewart. Learns his wife has just died as English troops close in on his castle. This, among the three, written in 1606. Here, Patrick Stewart as Macbeth.
Tomorrow. And tomorrow. And tomorrow. Creeps in this petty pace from day to day. To the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays of lighted fools away to dusty death. Out. Out. Brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. And then he's heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Patrick Stewart as Macbeth. Tale, life told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Jim Shapiro in New York. Where was the bard taken in and by this year? Was it to despair? Was it to revelation? How do you read these tragedies?
It's extraordinary listening to Patrick. I saw him perform that, and I still have shivers listening to him every time I hear him do that. That great speech ends with nothing. And that's where King Lear begins and ends. It's almost like Shakespeare's going through his Beckett phase in 1606. It is a dark year. When I think of how difficult it is to explain the dark places his plays go this year, I think of the first play that he finished. He had started it in 1605, and it was King Lear. And Shakespeare never made up his plots. He always took what somebody else had written, figured out what was wrong or passed sell-by date about it, I suppose, mm-hmm. and then rewrote it. There had been an old play called King Lear that had been on the boards for 15 years and was spelled L-E-I-R rather than L-E-A-R. Mm. And it was just published in the summer of 1605. And if you and I had been theatergoers in the Elizabethan days, we might have loved this play and loved the happy ending where King Lear is restored to his throne and kingdom and reconciled with his lovely youngest daughter, Cordelia. Well, it's going to be Cordelia. It starts as Cordelia. Mm-hmm. So Shakespeare takes this old story, which playgoers loved and had flocked to see, and he decides, I'm going to turn this into the darkest play imaginable, a Jacobean play rather than an Elizabethan one suited to these dark times. And as you and I and countless hundreds of others in the playhouse would have expected that happy ending, all of a sudden King Lear enters with Cordelia dead in his arms and dies shortly thereafter.
No happy ending here.
It's not only is it not a happy ending, it's as if all the characters are hit by a truck. It's mm-hmm. just an unbelievable show-stopping moment. And I think when you have set up the audiences to expect reconciliation and give them such destruction, it speaks to a darkness as dark as the ending that Patrick Stewart's Macbeth just recited.
Let's hear a little of this. We have Ian McKellen, just that point in the production. This is from 2009, but here playing King Lear with his faithful daughter, Cordelia, in his arms, a daughter he'd cast out because she refused to falsely flatter him. And here he is. Now, there had been a happy ending, not in Shakespeare's hands. She's dying, dead, and he's coming to the realization.
Featherstairs, she lives. If it be so, it is a chance that does redeem more sorrows than ever I have felt.
Oh, my good master.
Lead thee away.
It is noble Kent. Friend.
A plague upon you, murderous traitors, all I might have saved. Now she's gone forever. Cordelia.
Ian McKellen as King Lear, and it's just despair. Audiences at the time, you say, couldn't take it, Jim, what Shakespeare did with this play.
It was too dark. You know, there's an early printed version from 1608, 2 years after the play was first staged in London. And that's even darker than the version you just heard. Mm. The version Ian McKellen is working from at the end of this play is from the 15 years later, the 1623 first folio, where Shakespeare just pulls back from the abyss a half step. And you know that audiences like the happy ending because when theater after the English Civil War took up again, they changed King Lear back to a happy ending. And that's the way it was staged for 150 years until the early 19th century. No one can really handle a play quite as dark as this then or in many ways now, although I think our own dark age finds a play like this and its darkness compatible with our own sensibilities and in many ways, grim times.
We're going deeper into how Shakespeare dealt with that darkness in these three masterpiece tragedies. Jim Shapiro's new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. Roscoe is calling from Edinburgh, Virginia. Roscoe, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I just said earlier the comment was made, Tom, about can we look at any writer without knowing that writer's times? Mm. No. I mean, Shakespeare's like anyone. Shakespeare was, in my mind, was a product of his time and what was going on. And I would imagine if we could go back and see Lear or Macbeth and were citizens of that time, we might think, oh, gosh, I know that person. I think that he was just like any good writer, was showing us, his audiences, what was going on in his time.
And what about these tragedies coming out of 1606, Roscoe? Macbeth, Lear?
Yeah, they're true. I mean, this is what people... Lear faced it. I'm not a Shakespearean scholar, so I'm on shaky ground, but, you know, Lear faced struggles that we all face. And in Macbeth, my God, we all face the struggle for power and greed and success. Or maybe different levels.
Or the temptation of going to the dark side.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, yes. I mean, you know, there's a $20 bill that a coworker dropped, and you need some money for lunch. I mean, you know, it's trivial, but yet it's the same thing. We all face it. And that beautiful line from Macbeth, where Banquo finds out about his wife and children being slaughtered by Macbeth's killers, and he's told that you must avenge it like a you must avenge this like a man, and he says, yes, but first I must feel it like a man. I mean, that's universal. That right there was good for then, and it's good for now, that you got to feel things. I think that it's, you know, Shakespeare was like all of us. He's a product of what was going on around and in his world.
But to feel it, see it through the eyes and the art of William Shakespeare brings a depth to it that I feel armed up by in 2015, Jim Shapiro. And Roscoe, thank you so much for your call. But this is aid in time of need, Jim.
You know, listening to Roscoe's description of that moment in Macbeth and the passage that was so beautifully recited, I'm thinking back to last spring when I went with a group of eight actors to Rikers Island. A pretty grim place to be incarcerated
yeah.
mm-hmm. in New York City. And an actor named Rob Campbell was playing Macbeth and did the tomorrow, tomorrow, and tomorrow speech to a group of people who were criminals for the most part. And they were riveted. I mean, these were people who had probably never read or heard this play. And somebody was speaking words that spoke directly to their experience, to their sense of remorse, to their sense of ambition gone wrong. So these plays really do speak to us, even if we don't have the training in the history and culture of that moment, this stuff comes through.
Michael Dearda writes up your book for the Washington Post, calls it exciting, revelatory. He comes away saying this: English culture in the early 17th century, of course, 1606 right there, and think about the current resonance here, dear listeners, a world of callous and self-righteous authorities, of casual violence and willful deception, a brutal world in which young people are abandoned and mistreated, Rikers Island, the physically or psychologically ill are abused, maybe Rikers, and those who give the wrong answers are punished, a disturbing social universe not all that far from the one imagined in King Lear. Jim Shapiro, one of our listeners, writes in on the website, says, Lear hits close to home these latter days of capitalism in America. Abandonment of the old, the sick, the needy. For what? There's a contagious cruelty that comes with fear of loss of wealth and loss of life.
I think that's beautifully put, and I probably couldn't better it. There are just scenes in this play where Lear tries to indict the society that he was in charge of and recognizes the social ills from simply not having understood how to be the kind of leader he needed. And, you know, we're gearing up for an election in this country, and Shakespeare's words are bouncing around in my head as I read the headlines every morning.
Or then the challenge to moral fiber that comes here. There's a great moment you've pointed out for us in Macbeth. Where this is a high school teacher. We got this off YouTube, but Barry Delaney, good job. Mr. Delaney, he plays Macbeth, and he's pondering whether he should kill King Duncan, a king he admires, so that he might fulfill the prophecy he had from the witches that he'll be king. Shouldn't do it. Admires the king, but still he's thinking about it. And here's a soliloquy that our good teacher Delaney posted on YouTube a couple of years back.
If it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. If the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all, here, but here upon this bank and shoal of time, we'd jump the life to come.
From Macbeth, Jim Shapiro, there's Macbeth, like, I don't know, some modern trader on Wall Street considering something shouldn't do, but gosh, if we did it, oh, we'd jump the life to come, we'd sure be living large then.
You know, there's no better speech that's ever been written about somebody trying to con himself, trying to persuade himself to do something he doesn't want to do. And if you go back and listen to that speech, Macbeth says the same thing three times in different languages, in different words, rather. He can't quite even name the man, Duncan, he's going to kill. He uses a big word, assassination, which no one had ever used before Shakespeare introduced it at this moment.
The word itself was new to the language.
Absolutely. And it must have struck those at the Globe Theater as, what was that word? Mm-hmm. And it kind of stands for a man who doesn't want to say, I'm going to kill my king and kinsman. He can't say that. So he's kind of working around it. And it's the self-deception and the evasiveness that is so remarkable about that speech.
Does it help you grapple with our times? And on what front most acutely? On the terror front? On the plague front? On the polarization and division front?
I'd have to say I'm a native New Yorker, and 9/11 is with me and everyone who looks at the skyline downtown every time they're in the city in Manhattan. I think I understand something about the world that shaped Macbeth far better after 2001 than I did before. The gunpowder plot was the first massive terrorist threat, and it's really hard to understand that unless you have been through it. It was an attack that led the government to, like today, leave no crisis unexploited. So it registered not just on a visceral level. And for Shakespeare, who knew people on both sides. He knew some of the plotters, mm-hmm. and was connected to them, and he knew people who were in pursuit of them. So he had an unusual vantage point, but everyone in England, I think, was reeling from this, asking questions that we asked after 9/11. Where does this kind of evil come from?
The king, King James, called them the rarest sort of monsters, and Shakespeare heard that, brought it right into Macbeth.
Imagine you're hearing King James talk about these, the ones who were captured and brought to London as the rarest sorts of monsters. And then at the end of Macbeth, Macduff says to the king killing Macbeth, yield thee, coward, and live to be a show and gaze of the time. We'll have thee as our rarer monsters are, painted upon a pole. I mean, it's going right from the street into the theater. And we think about those monsters, and we think about the monstrousness. Does it come from devils? Does it come from religion? Does it come from the hearts of men and women? Where does this kind of evil come from? And that's at the heart of the play that Shakespeare wrote in Macbeth.
But there, the language of King James brought right into his work, as if George W. Bush on the rubble pile at World Trade Center were later become part of some great play.
It may well yet be. Somebody might quote his words.
Maybe not too late. James Shapiro's new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. We're going to dive right on in. It's so great to have you here. A little music to take us out. The Macbeth finale from the Orchestra de Teatro alla Scala di Milano. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about William Shakespeare and the year 1606, a very difficult year, a year of plague and strife, maybe a distant echo of our own time, the year Shakespeare wrote, brought out Macbeth, King Lear, Antony and Cleopatra. James Shapiro, professor of English at Columbia University, writes it up in his new book, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606, author of Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare, and 1599, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare. This one, dark. Three masterpiece tragedies came out of it, and they may speak to us today. You can join us. Can you picture the great Shakespeare sitting in the midst of all this turmoil, trying to make sense of life, writing those tragedies? Do you find consolation, insight, guidance, fellow feeling in Shakespeare's work from 1606? What can we learn here now from the Bard? Jim Shapiro joins us from New York, and Marilyn is with us from Virginia Beach. Virginia, Marilyn, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. This program brought to mind several years ago when we as an agency was asked to participate in the Virginia stage production of Lear. And I was relatively new as a geriatric care manager and learning the craft, but I was impressed with the similarity between what was going on in 1600 and what is going on today. And the problems are similar. As a geriatric care manager, I'm a professional, I'm a nurse, and with our assessment, we come in and determine the medical, social, environmental, and psychological issues impacting the care of the person who is to become our client. And it's so similar. The quality of life and the health status, of this is surfacing in life today as it was in Lear. So the similarity is...
When you're in geriatric care, what do you mean, Marilyn? The families squabbling over estate as their loved one?
Oh, yes, everything. There are so many scenarios. It's almost like having a stage environment with
Gosh.
Players. And
I had never thought of it, but like seeing you're saying King Lear played out again and again and again and again right in front of you in your work.
Absolutely. And there is the Cordelia, very often the Cordelia, and many others impacting, hopefully impacting the person's life. But it serves the persons who are essentially alone, whose family lives out of the area. So there's a different environment than it was in Lear. But all of the issues are the same. It's a comprehensive look at a person and the impact of the family on the elderly.
Marilyn, we've got it. Geriatric care and King Lear resurrected again and again and again, right in those mini-dramas, maybe not so small for those in the midst of it. I mean, that could be at any time, I suppose, Jim, but as our listener wrote earlier, in a time when money is big and people do anything to get it, maybe the drama gets cranked higher.
Listen to that really insightful comment. Makes me really aware of the ways in which there are things deeply embedded in Shakespeare's plays that come into greater focus at different moments in time, which means that each age has its own Lear. Right now, with dementia and Alzheimer's so prevalent, you'll see more and more productions of this play that show Lear really as a geriatric patient in a lot of ways, in the same way that 50 years ago during the Cold War, the play was seen as this apocalyptic end-of-world drama. So, and in our own age of terror that we've been discussing, plays like Macbeth and Lear take on a different color. These are really embedded deeply, baked into these plays. And as our preoccupations change, those aspects that Shakespeare understood 400 years ago come into much greater relief.
I wonder if you see this as having palpably, spiritually turned William Shakespeare in this particular time. You're centering on 1606. Of course, it spills over before and after. But with three great tragedies in one year, was he darkened or was he, as a playwright, enlivened by... this is rich material.
We don't know. The one line that I can cross is, I don't know what was in Shakespeare's heart. all I know is how he was able to respond and let the world around him shape his feeling and thinking. We have the plays. We don't have the man.
I mean, Michael Derrida reading you describes what Shakespeare, archetypal Elizabethan dramatist, says might have had some trouble adjusting to the new Jacobean age.
Well, that is true. One of the things that Shakespeare did have trouble adjusting to was understanding that world. You know, in between Hamlet and Lear, he wrote five or so plays. That's not a lot for Shakespeare. Typically, in a productive year, he would write two, three, even four plays. So it's fairly clear that he wasn't in stride. He wasn't really grappling with the same issues those around him were. I'm sure younger playwrights were saying, he's over the hill, he's a has-been, he's an old Elizabethan guy who doesn't speak to this moment. And I think that he bore down in 1606. It must have exhausted him somewhat, because in the two or three years following this, his productivity went down again to, you know, they're great plays, Coriolanus and Pericles, but they're not on the order of Shakespeare's Macbeth or Lear or even Antony and Cleopatra. So this was one of those inspired moments. It took me 10 years to really grapple with it in this book, and even that was not enough time for me to fully feel I understood these masterpieces.
I think after Macbeth and Lear and Antony Cleopatra, a playwright deserves a little break, though. I don't know. Maybe there were no reruns, no money coming in from reruns in those days. Neil in Watertown, Massachusetts. Neil, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, sir.
I would like to focus on Edgar in King Lear. I'm not a rosy-eyed optimist, but it seems that he makes the most of a bad situation, to say the least, and he leaves us with something to go by. In Act 2, Scene 3, it's a long story, but I'm sure the professor knows, and many people know, that he's been framed horribly by his brother, so he has to pretend he's a beggar. So he looks around in a wood, and he thinks, and he's preparing himself psychologically. He says, the country gives me proof and precedent of bedlam beggars who with roaring voices strike in their numbed and mortified bare arms. So, and as things progress, they end up at the cliffs, the White Cliffs of Dover, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he's with his father, whose eyes have been plucked out, and he convinces his father, and while he's still Tom, in the persona of Tom, that his father is going to commit suicide. But he convinces his father, because he can't see, that he has jumped off a cliff when, in fact, he's only fallen a few feet. Mm. So Edgar says, "Hast thou been aught but gossamer, feathers, air, so many fathom down precipitating? Thou shivered like an egg, but thou dost breathe. Hast heavy substance, bleedst not, speakst, art sound, 10-masted each, make not the altitude which thou hast perpendicularly fell." Then he says, "This is, I've known this ever since I was a teenager. Thy life's a miracle. Speak yet again." So I would say it's a miracle, yeah, obviously, because he supposedly survived the fall from the cliff, but just, you know, life's a miracle, so make the most of it. This is a quickening of the sentence. The senses that I've heard was encouraged in Elizabeth's time.
Even that, in a dark time, maybe especially. And, of course, Edgar, disguised as a madman much of the time there, you take us right to the cliff there, Neil, and I appreciate your reading. What do you say, Jim?
I thought Neil read that beautifully and put his finger right on one of the critical issues Shakespeare faced in creating the story. Edgar is a young man who's watching the devastation go on around him and sees things as miracles. The play keeps raising the possibility of miraculous salvation and dashing it on the rocks. People say the gods defend us, and the next moment we see the dead Cordelia in Lear's arms. I had mentioned earlier that Shakespeare pulled back from the abyss of the ending that he first wrote for King Lear. In the first ending, he gave the final speech of the play to a character named Albany, who is the traditionally highest ranking figure and always gets to speak the last speech of the play. His wife is dead. He's not going to have children. It's obviously going to be a sterile, dark ending. When Shakespeare changed King Lear, he gave the final speech in the revised version that was in the first folio of 1623 to Edgar. So at least we have, or Neil has, the sense of Edgar restoring the possibility of a decent future. I myself like the initial dark ending. Don't go with the Edgar restoring some possibility of hope, but that probably says more about me than it does about Shakespeare.
I was struck in here at your description of what sounded to me a little bit like Stephen Colbert's truthiness in this age, and how all these dark difficulties and the ferocity of people attacking one another led to a kind of universal equivocation as a mode of being.
Shakespeare had used that word equivocation in Macbeth, in Hamlet, 5 or 6 years earlier, in a totally neutral way. One of the buzzwords, big words of 1606 was equivocation. In the aftermath of the gunpowder plot, the authorities were searching everywhere for evidence, and they came upon a treatise of equivocation in the lodgings of one of the plotters. And it became Exhibit A in the trial of the gunpowder plotters. And
it's sort of a how-to guide for Catholics under the gun or sword
point. If you need to lie to the authorities, you'd say a priest lieth not in my house, thinking that you mean that he's not telling lies there rather than residing there. This drove the authorities crazy and upset everybody because it legitimated lying or a certain kind of lying. Shakespeare heard this word bouncing around this year on everybody's lips, and he embeds it into Macbeth, where Macbeth talks about the equivocation of the fiend, or the porter goes on again and again in his drunken little episode in the middle of the play about equivocation. And I think it becomes...
Read that bit for us if you've got it, Jim.
I'm sure I do somewhere.
But I see here there's this bit, I pull in resolution and begin to doubt the equivocation,
of the fiend.
That lies like truth. And their truthiness in 1606.
It is, and it made people really disturbed that honest exchange between human beings was now almost impossible. If you could legitimate equivocation, you could think one thing and say another, believing that God knew your thoughts. That's not the way people do business, converse, and act in a civil society. So that word, which is so central to Macbeth, and every character, even the good characters in Macbeth, end up equivocating. Mm. There's a wonderful exchange between Lady Macduff and her young son, and they're both about to be brutally murdered by Macbeth's henchmen. And the son says to his mother, "Was my father a traitor, mother?" And she says, "Aye, that he was." And he says, "What's a traitor?" And she replies, "Why, one that swears and lies." Those four lines of exchange speak. It's as simple as that. And she's equivocating with him even as she's describing what equivocation is, one who swears and lies. Shakespeare got it. He knew it. He knew that people were obsessing about this, and it goes right into that play and our own skepticism about people who now tell us one thing and think another goes right back to that moment.
Sri in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Sri. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was calling because I was fascinated by, the discussion mainly about the origin and where does this kind of evil in humanity come from, and also the last thing that Professor Shapiro was saying is about the ripple effects of this. But one of the things I just wanted to talk about in terms of Macbeth, which I find has a lot of currency even today, is that once you choose the route of evil, you often begin on a rather small scale, and you think, we're going to just do something that's a little bit dark. But what Shakespeare, I think, really brings to the foreground is, the amazing kind of the desensitizing effect of evil, that you start small, but then it becomes so normalized that even bigger things seem okay. And I was thinking especially about that beautiful speech where Macbeth is saying, "I am in blood stepped in so far that should I wait no more, returning where Astygia says go o'er. And I was just thinking about the currency of this because, you know, new recruits to terrorist groups, something as large scale as that, but even smaller things, you know, like hedge funds and investment, projects, how they start, you know, a little bit iffy, but then it just gets so huge that they end up in prison.
Sriel, I love your call. We've got 1 minute right here. The evil starting small and swelling, Jim Shapiro.
That was brilliantly put. I love that. And all I can say is that evil is seductive. Macbeth is the hero. Edmund the bastard in Lear, who is as villainous in a lot of ways as Macbeth, perhaps more, is appealing to us. So Shakespeare not only does what Shree points out, shows how things start in a small way and escalate and snowball, that speaks to our own moment, but he also captures our own fascination with evil. And for that reason, too, these plays are worth reading, seeing, and reflecting on.
We've only got 20 seconds. Is there consolation in reading here, Jim, or just fellow feeling? He was in the deep, dark stuff. Sometimes it feels the same today.
I find consolation in sharing these plays with audiences, with those calling in. It speaks to us all collectively, and it's a kind of secular scripture, if you will.
The Year of King Lear, of Macbeth, of Antony and Cleopatra, masterpiece tragedies from Shakespeare. James Shapiro's new book is The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. Jim, thank you very much for being with us today. Just wonderful.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.